A shocking 97% of all people say they struggle to get others to do what they want, but fail miserably at it. Actually, I just made that up. That's not a real statistic. However, it's one of those things that I just know to be true. As much as we would love to be able to just sprinkle a few magic words in someone's ear and they would do what we want them to do, that's just not how it happens. There's a greater context to it, and that is knowing how to influence people. So if you're wondering, what psychological principles can you use to influence people? If you're wondering if a person can learn how to get people to do what they want, or is it something you have to be born with? And if you're wondering about how to handle resistance or objections from others, you're in the right place. These are the questions we'll be answering on this podcast, along with my co-host, Yulia and Nate, as well as a special guest, a close friend of mine who has a talent for getting people to do what he wants, Chris Buich. Actually, there's a lot of talent on this podcast right now. We all specialize in certain areas of getting people to do what we want. Nate and Chris are business leaders who are great at sales and wonderful at getting their employees to do what they want, something I've always struggled with. I went from being terrible at sales to being really good at it. My coaching practice taught me how to move people toward fulfilling their potential. I also excelled at seduction when I was single, and I built a YouTube channel with almost 90,000 subscribers. And Yulia is great at getting her husband to do what she wants. All right, so let's get into this. How do we get people to do what we want? So as I mentioned, your area would be more in business and working with employees. That was the what I noticed when we actually shared an office together, both as insurance agents. And I thought you were really good at being able to motivate people to hit the goals that you wanted them to hit. And I always struggled with this because I thought if I just pay them, that's enough, right? Like, I pay you to do a job and you're going to do that job. But I found out very quickly that's really not the case. And you would even get on my case about it. You would say, Damon, that's not what employees are really wanting. It takes more than that.
They don't care about that. You care about that. It's your business. It's your goal. It's your dream. So that's what you care about. Your employees care about, of course, their goals and their dreams, which if they choose the vehicle of your job, then you work within those confines. But I don't think an employee is ever going to have your dream or share your dream with you unless they just so happen to be a similar dreamer as you are.
Don't they want to get paid?
Absolutely want to get paid, but only as a function. I think 99% of people have no interest in money other than the exchange that we use in our system, which was mind-blowing for me to learn. I didn't always know that. That's not intuitive to me.
Well, I think that's normal, though. Like, I mean, yeah, that's why you want money. You want money to pay your rent, pay your bills, go out and have fun, travel, whatever it is. I mean, it's what the money will do for you. Yeah, I agree with you. There's very few people, a very small percentage of the population who are actually motivated and driven by money. Most people are, they're driven by what the money will do for them. And I just thought that if you want money to do whatever it is that you want to do with it, then naturally as an employee, you're going to do a good job. So you get paid. So you use that money to do what you want. But I think that's probably antiquated at this point. Like, that just doesn't exist anymore.
So just the question, when you are an employee, were you motivated solely by money? Were you getting done everything your boss was telling you?
Well, I'm actually not one of those people who is motivated by money. I'm motivated by what money can do for me. But I would say yes. You know what motivated me more as an employee than anything else? And this was probably my budding entrepreneurial spirit starting to come out. I wanted the boss to leave me alone. I didn't want to be bothered. So I thought if I just do my job really well to the point that they don't have to check on me, if they know that I'm on it, they just go, he's on it and he always completes the job. So we don't have to worry about it. I just didn't like being bothered. So I did a really good job so that they wouldn't bother me.
Well, in that instance, then it's my job as the leader or the coach or owner, whatever, is to understand that about you specifically, which is different than the person next to you and the person next to them, and make sure that the goals that I give to you for you to then perform, for me to leave you alone, are the goals that I need as the owner to be done. And that's a perfect world. And that would be a wonderful employee. And you probably were. Usually, entrepreneurs started as good employees. Most people didn't jump into that unless you were born into entrepreneurship, which even then I would consider myself that. My parents were entrepreneurs, but it's hard to get it until you get it. So you can have good modeling and you can have people that you look up to and admire that do a good job. But again, it comes back to their dream is going to be different than your dream, or their motivation in your case being left alone is going to be different than somebody else. So that is the very first piece of what I would say is my duty, my role as a coach and a leader, is to understand what you're after. And that comes through active listening. People don't even know what they're after. And I think actually we've talked about this before.
Quite a bit.
You told me at least once, maybe a lot of times, people actually know what they don't want a lot more than they know what they want.
For sure.
And I find that to be entirely true. And why? No idea. Don't care. That's for you brain scientists to figure out. But really what I'm going to try to do is listen to the keys you're giving me. And this is true whether I'm talking to an employee or a prospect. Well,
that's what I was going to say, because not everybody here are own a business or have employees. So let's make this a little more universal. So it's not just how you motivate your employees and get them to do what you want. How do you, in general, what's the first thing? And we should probably go around, do a round robin on this. What is the first thing that you do when you want to influence someone to do what you want?
Yeah. So first thing is to actively listen to that person. So you have to engage them in conversation. So I'm assuming we've engaged somebody in conversation. And then we have to actively listen. And I think, I presume everybody understands what active listening is. But what I've learned is that that's actually also not true. And that conceptually we do. From a book, we understand what that phrase means, but we don't know how to actually implement that.
Okay, well, now that you put yourself on the hook for that, let's hear. What does a person need to know to actually actively listen?
Yeah, so I think some principles, and the principles are that people are self-motivated. People act the way they are incented to act, / the closest they can get to what they want and are incented to do.
Footnote, money doesn't count. Money doesn't count as a motivation.
Well, money sometimes counts, but not in the universal sense of this. If it was the employee, then it counts, potentially. I would just argue that no pay plan I've ever put together has worked. So meaning until I have spent the time to engage someone, in that case, an employee, but in any case, engage somebody and understand what they're after, then I have very little chance of motivating them, influencing them. And when it comes to employment, then there is a hierarchy. So there's some influence you have that is just money, but it's not the ultimate influence. It's not the influence that's going to get you to where you want to go. Seems to be the starting place. And I guess I would agree with you that it's antiquated. It should be personalized and not generalized. But in any case, active listening is the first step.
So how would you start that conversation? Or I know you're saying you're already engaged in conversation, but how do you then take that conversation and move it to what you're talking about, where you're finding out, well, what really motivates this person? And I've assumed after that, then it's about, well, how do I align with that? But before we get to that, so between the fluff conversation and the part where you go, okay, now I want to, so we call that pacing and leading and NLP for you NLPers out there. So how do you go about leading? How do you go about starting to move them in that direction?
Asking questions. So I need to know about you, and people want to talk about themselves in general. And I know that sounds kind of funny. It doesn't mean everybody's arrogant and self-centered and wants to brag on themselves.
Give me an example of a question you would ask?
Well, I would just probably start by asking you about your family. Okay. For me, asking about your family, and that would be different depending on who I'm engaging. So for you, as a married person, as somebody that has kids, that's a pretty easy conversation. I can get you into that pretty quickly. If you were a single person, you know, I'm probably going to hear about your parents, siblings, grandparents, that kind of thing. There's a ton of information that I need to align what I want with what you want in that conversation.
So you think asking about family is a way to get to what their motivations are very quickly?
People care about their family, okay? And they're passionate about their family. And passion can be good, it can be bad, but
okay, well, let's say I'm 20-something years old. I moved here from Louisiana. I don't have a family. And you start asking about my family. And I say, well, yeah, I've got parents and brothers back in Louisiana, but I don't talk to them much. And I'm trying to carve out a new life for myself. Where would you go with that?
Why? So the magic, okay, you talked about magic words. The magic word is why. So I'm the most curious person in the world.
So I stay away from that word because it makes people defensive.
Okay, well, you have to give me an example because I don't have that same experience.
So especially in an objection, I would say more so for an objection than anything else. But if somebody says, you know, I did this and the scenario I just mentioned, I don't want to have to repeat it.
Yeah.
And I would go, well, why did you do that? Like, if somebody told me that, I'd go, whoa, it feels like now I'm asking to defend my position here of why I did that. However, if I were asking that question, I'd say something like, oh, what led you to do that? Or what made you do that? So I'm not going to just ask why. If you think about when kids ask why, you have kids and they just go on with why, and you're just like, oh my God. So you don't want to engage in that.
So you do want to engage in that. You just want to be more eloquent than the kid and have more words than why, but it's all why. So tell me more about that, or tell me what led you to that. That is why. So same thing. So it's thank you for the distinction, though. It's not necessarily specifically the word why. It's the question. Tell what motivated you to do that, right? And the reason I want to know why is because you're giving me information about how you are compelled to act. I need to know what compels you to action in order to then be able to motivate you that direction. If I don't know that, then it's about me. And if it's about me, hey, sometimes that will align with the person you're talking to, right? Let's just say in your circumstance, when you met Yulia, right? Sometimes you engage somebody in a conversation and they end up having a common goal with you right away. So, okay, great. But
she wanted a green card.
But you know, statistically speaking, it's not going to be everybody. So you have to understand what's going to compel somebody to act. So for me, asking about family or friends so I'm a big family person. So that tends to be an easy way for me to connect. I also have a big family, a diverse family. And when I say diverse, I more mean in where everybody comes from than, culturally or socioeconomically or anything like that. But it's an easy way to connect. Just getting to know somebody. So if they have a dog, then that's the question you should be asking is tell me about your dog, right? Or if the person is dressed in a particular way, to compliment the way they're dressed, but to ask them about their style, they're clearly posturing and wanting people to understand something about them. That's what style is. So whatever the cue is that person is giving you could be a nice watch. It could be a lot of things. If you are actively paying attention, then they will give you the information you need to then further that conversation.
So I'm so much more literal and direct than that, but I feel like I'm learning something here. I feel like I could probably do more of that. And I think back, just to close the loop on me as an employer and my struggle with that, was I just felt lost when I put that out in front of them, what I was going to pay them, what I was going to bonus them, which would have motivated me. And it was just like, not happening. And I was just, you know, like whenever you knock that you see the line of ants and you just knock them away. And then that next ant just does not know where to go. And like, he goes off in all different directions. That was me. I was like, I don't know where to go from here. If this is not what you're interested in, why do you even want a job? Anyway, obviously there's more to it. And that's why I felt much more comfortable like outsourcing and people who are self-motivated. And then the truth is like, I don't want to have to motivate you if I'm paying you. I feel like I'm paying you so I don't have to motivate you. And so I have a different approach. Now, Nate, I want you to jump in here because I think you are also really talented at this. And in addition to that, which I think Chris is more subtle than I am, I think you're even more subtle than Chris. And you're able to really move people to do things. Since we've been working together, I've always been amazed by that. I'm like, you just have a very indirect style. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you go about this?
Sure. I was journaling a few minutes before our call today, and I noticed that one of the things that's meant the most to me in the outcomes that I've created in my life has been actively listening to someone else and what's important to them, and then just looking for ways to solve the puzzle with them and seeing if there's a way that I can align a mutual self-interest, right? And it's really that simple. And so if we were to think, it could be my youngest daughter and me wanting her to brush her teeth. It could be a team member that wants to increase their income. It could be a joint venture partner of some kind. No matter what, it's always been being present with someone long enough to understand what's important to them, looking for the puzzle that they're trying to solve, seeing if I can become a great partner in solving that puzzle, and then looking at the consequences if they don't solve that puzzle, because that's also another important element to understand.
So I feel pretty competent in all of those areas that you mentioned, except for one. How do you get your daughter to do what you want?
So we can actually, this will be fun. Actually, we could actually look at this for a second. And the other component part is that you can build a bridge for them, right? Can you solve that puzzle with them? And then of course, can you communicate to them in their own language? And you're very skilled at all of those things. And so, in Penelope's standpoint, I want her to brush her teeth. And she,
here, can you tell us how old she is?
Penelope is 3.
Okay.
And so at the time of this recording,
I just want to say for everyone out there, if you have never dealt with a 3-year-old, it's an amazing exercise to test your abilities to persuade and influence, to be able to get a 3-year-old. I mean, you can always make them, right? And then they're going to be screaming and crying, but you want to avoid that. So this is a real challenge. I'm serious about that. This is a real challenge.
It really is. So let's use some of the things that I heard you all talking about and a couple of things that I mentioned. With Penelope, I know she wants to be a princess. Now that's quite an aspirational thing. Right, she wants to be a princess, you know. So, and I know that about her, and so I try to help her solve that puzzle with princess dresses, with you know, a good tea party every once in a while, and also I know that a princess likes to have a clean outfit and shiny teeth. So if I can communicate that to her and build and make that and be the person that can solve that puzzle with her, and that might be that I help her bring the toothbrush to her, all those types of things. It sounds simple, but the principles fit everywhere, really. You know,
that makes a lot of sense. I have to say that, you know, I mean, no story out there tells us that the princess is brushing her teeth, or, you know, no story recommends these healthy habits to the kids. But when you position it like that, it makes so much more sense. Obviously, a princess is like, oh, look at that picture. Do you see how shiny her smile is? You want your smile to be shiny, right? That's brilliant.
I want to point something out that's a bit off topic, but Nate's cadence and tone are super important, I believe, in his influence over people.
I don't think that's off topic at all. Tell us, say
it's
more about it.
So very calming and soothing and nurturing that I feel like in a short period of time, Nate can connect with people easily. And I know that because we've actually only met a couple of times and I feel like we're close. Yeah, yeah. So, and that's part of almost a hypnotic cadence to your voice and to your tone. And I hadn't been able to articulate that until just now when I'm thinking about it and hearing you speak. But I think that resonates with a 3-year-old, and I think that resonates with an 80-year-old. I think we all want to feel.
Me. Are you trying to say that? I am the oldest.
I mean,
one
the oldest
here.
One in the crowd, whatever that crowd is. Yeah, I think that I don't know, Nate, if that's intentional or if that's natural. Either way, it's highly effective. And I think one thing that I'm sure you're very familiar with, all of you, is matching and mirroring folks. So to have an understanding of communication, not only the spoken word, but the physical communication, you see me moving around like a wild person, physical communication, tonality, all the subtleties of communication,
the nonverbals
are actually the majority of communication.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's really important to be aware of that, at least to have a style. So I don't want to necessarily say a strategy, but it may start as a strategy and then turn into a style. And in fact, that's what I see when training salespeople, for example. They don't have a style, or they have a bad style, and we have to change that. And so it starts as a strategy and a somewhat structured approach with the hope that then it integrates and it becomes natural. And so when I say it versus when Nate says it, even if the words are the same, it has a unique style to it. And hopefully one that helps you influence and, you know, isn't abrasive.
So, well, then my question is, and I agree with what you're saying about Nate, how intentional is that?
I don't really think about it at all.
You say it's more of an unconscious strategy? Because we definitely have that. And I think we learn those very early in life. I think kids are the best persuaders. And whatever strategies they forge, that's usually what they stick with. Whatever works. That was the most amazing thing about my daughter. It was like she didn't care if a strategy failed. And I learned this from her. She just grabbed the next strategy. Okay, that one fails, grab the next strategy. She never got attached to a strategy. She was only focused on the outcome. So it's like you just keep firing away until you get something. And then from that, I think we cultivate these strategies very early in life. And then we do kind of attach to them. I think the best thing to do is kind of detach from them. But do you think that this is something you found got your way early in life, and so you continue to use that, or is it something you developed later?
I mean, that's a great question. I have studied quite a bit in that area, but I in my day-to-day interactions, I'm not thinking about it at all. I do know that I am really interested in the best interest of the other person. And I think that in reflection, as we're talking, I think that does come through in my tone. I think it does. When I was a teenager, I was kind of bouncing, or I was... one of the ways that I was able to have a consistent dinner was to have friends that and their families would make dinner. And so I did, and at that point, talking about strategies we learned when we were young, I did intentionally become the kid that those parents wanted their kid to be around, so that way I could have dinner.
Yeah. I think.
And you eat a lot, so I can imagine. Like, they were like, oh, you know, we really like
you. Got to really like that.
Yeah, we really like him. But man, he eats all the food. Like, we
that's interesting. Yeah, I think having a childlike approach, the way you described Ari's willingness to go from one strategy to the next, we lose that as we become adults.
We become inflexible.
entirely. And I feel it more. You know, I think I joke about it. Like, I'm starting to feel like the grumpy old man. And, you know, like this younger generation is this insanely one, you know, crazy liberal. And I don't mean that in the actual way, but just wildly one direction. But it's really my inflexibility, right? It's really my lack of willingness to remove the strategy that isn't resonating with that person and implement a new one. And I feel like that's true of everything. We stop trying to do physical feats. We stop trying to maybe meet new people. We stop trying to do all kinds of things because of the failures we've experienced or the criticism we've experienced or whatever the external inputs are that we're receiving that aren't positive. And so maybe that's a piece of being able to influence people, is that you absolutely must get out of your process and your system and your need and tap into theirs. So if Nate does genuinely care, that makes that probably a little bit easier to do because you are actually interested in these things. I think for me, I have to practice that more. Probably going to sound terrible, but I'm not interested. And it doesn't mean that I don't care, but I don't really, I mean, if I'm trying to make a relationship, then I care. If this is business, for example, even if it's a business relationship, I don't actually care. I'm never going to meet those people. I'm never going to have a conversation with them. I don't know them.
You're talking about their family members.
Yeah. The other people, them. No, yeah. The other people that they're telling me about or talking about. However, I do care that I am able to help in the way that I can help. So I don't know how that is and we uncover that, but I do genuinely want to help. Mm-hmm. And I do genuinely want to give my time and resources and energy to you to solve a puzzle, just like Nate said. But in the context of business, there needs to be a common ground. I don't work for free. It's not a nonprofit. And so we do need to come to some sort of place where I can help you solve your puzzle, for money in that particular case, or, you know, it depends on what context you're in, but in business, that's the way that you have to sort of round that out. So it's interesting because in a way for me, it's impersonal because I'm not attached, but in a way it's very personal because I'm really trying to find out what you care about so that then I can align with that and move.
I like the frame you put on it, Nate, which is a puzzle. And I've heard you use that term a lot when it comes to solving business problems or working with people. And I think that brings a certain amount of levity to it. And because it does, and if you think of it as a puzzle or as a game, then you're not so rigid. You can be more flexible. It's if you approach it as, well, this is fun. It's a puzzle. I'm solving it. I don't think about it enough that way.
I need to piggyback on that. What another thing Nate's doing by introducing that puzzle concept?
We're deconstructing Nate right now.
Is I know it's much more fun than me. Is he's involving himself in the game. Now he's your partner. He's immediately your partner, your teammates. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Just in case we have something we may want to do, we're teammates already. And I think that that's a brilliant strategy because it lends to that person, but also it conveniently cuddles you up to your, you know, your neighbor, your prospect, your friend, whatever it is, as their advocate and teammate. And so I think that that's an important subtlety to point out.
We're figuring you out, Nate. We got you. We got you.
And the neat thing is you can maybe open up a door, or you can connect to other people, or you could do, you know, there's so many ways to support someone and also make sure that it's ecological for you as well.
So are you, it sounds to me, and I'm going to get into my strategy a little bit more in just a moment, but it sounds to me like you're just trying to open up as many doors as possible because you don't know what yet. Would you say that's true? You're leading with opening those doors and finding a potential alignment. Is that what you're doing? Or are you going directly for the kill shot?
I think you described it. I've never thought of it that way consciously, but when you said that, it made a lot of sense. I think that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah. Cause my strategy is exactly the opposite. I'm just being honest. Right? I'm like hyper-focused on my objective, and my wife can probably attest to that. I'm hyper-focused on my objective.
Poor girl.
And part of my objective at first is to find out what's important to you. What turns you on? What does it for you? What opens you up? What do you want? And I mean, I start every conversation, every persuasive conversation that way, whether it's a client who is already a client, like already paid. So I'm not trying to sell them anything. I want to know what they want. I have to know what they want better than they do. And that's the way that I'm going to be able to move them, because in coaching, it is persuasion. It is influence. And so for anything else, it's the same thing. I have a very clear objective. I'm not going to come away from that. I'm not going to be thrown off from that objective. So let me find out what's really important to you. And then I need to find what do I have that aligns with what's really important to you. So I think we're all the same. We're pretty much saying the same first lesson. We just have a very different way of going about it, all three of us, which I'm not surprised. And that's why I wanted to have this conversation, because we're very different at it. But I'm going to say it like this, and if you want to alter it or add something to it, please do, both of you and you as well. The first thing you need to know is what is important to that person.
Definitely the first thing you need to know is what is important to that person. Or that's the first important thing to know. It's not always the first thing you do know, however.
Well, I mean, you do need to establish... I mean, you said like we're assuming that we already started the conversation. So that, and that's what I say is what rapport. Like we're already talking for a reason. You know, if it's I'm potentially going to hire you, that's the reason why we're talking. So there's a certain connection already.
Yeah.
You know, when I approached Yulia on the street and gave her a compliment, let her know exactly right away what I was interested in, then she keeps talking to me. Then my assumption is, okay, now I've been given permission to go further and ask her what's important to her. I think that happens with any kind of interaction where before persuasion begins, yes, there's a reason why you're talking. And if you're confused about that, if you don't know why that is happening, then there's not enough rapport to advance to what's important to you. Like if you ask that question before you have that rapport when you're still not sure why you're talking to this person, I'm not going to tell you what's important to me if I don't know why we're having this conversation. And then it happens like a salesperson calls on the phone. And if you've ever had that happen where before they really announce who they are and what they're after, they start asking you a bunch of questions. I'll say, Hey, tell me who you are and what you want. I'm not going to answer your questions. And I think that's in general true for anyone. Now they might not be as direct as I am, but they're not going to give you good information if you don't have a certain amount of rapport.
So I think it's important then. Yes, we're in this. It's already happened. But in case it's not intuitive, building that rapport, of course, is the first important thing, because you need to bring the walls down. So you said, right, if I don't know what you're calling about, I need to know who you are. So that's your defense walls coming up. Mm-hmm. And my job is to remove those. But I think there's a lot of ways to do that. And so, for example, there's something that's called a pattern interrupt. Okay. And I don't have the NLP way of explaining this. Okay. But everybody has their pattern. So when you get a sales call, all of us are sort of taught to hang up, slow down, find out what's going on, be defensive. It's a sales call. We know that we don't want to get sold. And now we need to be on our toes, so to speak. Well, you could potentially bring those walls down in a lot of different ways. And so negative, positive, funny, serious, straightforward, short, fast, I think they're, depending on your personal style, that's how you would sort of approach that. So My fault for saying we're already in the conversation. I probably assumed we had done that, but
no, it's fine. But I think to take a step back and to talk a little bit about, well, what is happening in that initial conversation. And I can already say that I think Nate, you're very subtle about this. And I think Chris already pointed it out, like you're coming from a place of I'm on your team and it's very nurturing. And so that puts people at ease right away. And then you're into rapport and then you can take that next step. My approach is I want to let you know what I'm up to right away. I don't want to feel like I have to, and I'm not saying you're hiding it at all. My approach is to get that out in front as soon as possible. And that usually puts people at ease because they go, wow, he's really transparent and he's really honest. And I'm like, well, yeah. And so they start to trust me. And then another word for trust is rapport.
Yeah.
And then I can start going into, well, let me find out what's really important to you. And that works for me. I think you have your style is kind of in between, like mine's at a 10 on one end and Nate's at a 10 on another end, and you're somewhere in between, I think.
And part of that's intentional. So I'm trying to blend more than you are, for example, right? Mm-hmm. You are exactly what you just said, trying to stand out and be intentional and be direct. And I'm not, only because not everybody likes that style. And I'm trying to appeal to the widest audience possible. So that is intentional. I think natural personality wise, I'm probably closer to what you would do. And I'd like to just blurt it out, get it done. But since my experience is that will limit a part of the population, potentially, maybe I tone that down a little bit. And then I'm just not as naturally nurturing or curious as Nate happens to be. So that would take a serious effort on my part to be able to go in that direction.
Yeah, I'd say I play the numbers a little more, and I'll admit I'm a little more transactional. But once I find that we do have common interests that is both important to us, then I really do want to connect. Like I'm really authentically interested in connecting.
So pretty much all of you guys have the same first approach, which is understanding what the person wants. And then the strategy...
We could say rapport is probably first.
Okay, rapport, yeah. And then understanding what they want, what's important for them. So what I'm trying to point out here is that you get me to do what you want me to do. You're
all
my husband, almost. And then Nate gets me to do what I'm supposed to do as an employee.
Really?
What podcast am I even on?
So the thing is, the steps are the same. The strategy is somewhat different. Actually, you were saying that you're opposites, but both of those strategies work with me. So what
are
I'm
you
trying to get
saying
at,
that you're a complex human being, that multiple things work with you?
Exactly. And the thing is, I'm sure that's available for lots of people. It's not like those who are listening, they have to decide, oh, is that strategy going to work just with some people or just with others? I think they are even more strategies than the three we covered, and more strategies can work on the same person.
I would agree with that and say that the more flexible you are with, when we talked a little bit about that earlier with my daughter, who just keeps changing out her strategies, the more flexible you are to change out your strategies, the better persuader and influencer you're going to be. If you get stuck in one way, then yeah, you're as soon as, like I mentioned, I mean, it took years where I had employees in my insurance business, and I just didn't know where to go after they just didn't seem to be interested in money, bonuses, or what have you. And I would have to say, I would take that even a little bit further, and I would say I wasn't interested in having to motivate them to do what I felt like I was already paying them to do. So I think there was a kind of a conflict of interest. And so I just know that I work much better if I find you on Upwork or something like that, and I hire you to do something. I want to be focusing that energy and that attention that most people need to be motivated on stuff that I'm working on. I would much rather pour that back into that. So that's why I think it's a really good business relationship with Nate here, because he is really good at handling that side of it. And I'm just not.
You're very much an artist, right? So you've got, whether you believe it or whether you know it or not.
So
and so I can imagine that most of your energy you'd prefer to be put into creating. That makes a lot of sense.
It's also the way that I functioned. It was like I mentioned before, I want to be left alone. I'll get the work done. Just leave me alone. Let me do my thing.
Yeah, it seems like you're not very interested in influencing, since you want to be doing your own thing. But I think...
Well, it depends on... It depends.
I think the challenge is that as an artist, there's only one of you. And you can't recreate that. Whereas if you're trying to scale something, it has to be recreated and it has to be scaled. And so I think that's where it's important to be able to influence. And nobody will ever be like you. And probably thank goodness, at least in my case, thank goodness there's one and only one. But that doesn't mean that there can't be an effective result or outcome from the next person. It doesn't look exactly like you do, but it looks close enough to where you can continue to scale. So yeah, that's why your partnership, I think, works really well. It's true. You're the artist and you're creating, and that's where you're feeling confident and in a good space. And
but that's its own influence too, because now I'm not influencing one-to-one, I'm influencing one-to-many. And I became fascinated with that idea, especially when I started this business, even before you and I partnered, Nate. And then I came across Jason Fladland, who's one of the top salespeople you'd probably ever meet if you do meet him. And his book, One to Many, is about webinar selling, which we do a lot of and which I really enjoy doing. I enjoy creating the webinar. I enjoy performing the webinar because it's mixed in with teaching. I love teaching because that is a form of persuasion and influence that is one to many. I feel like I get to reach a lot more people. So it's, you know, more bang for my buck. So it's, I have this weird way of like certain one-on-ones I'm really good with, not with employees. And then, I'm very much interested in the one to many influence. And, it, all of that works the same way. When you're dealing with an audience, you need to build rapport. You need, they need to know, well, why are we doing this to begin with? Why are you watching this video? Or why am I watching this video? Why am I listening to you speak? And so you have to do that as well. And then I have to make a lot of more assumptions because I can't, you know, ask questions to the audience. I can a little bit, but it gets really annoying. That's one thing I, if you're ever giving a presentation, never, ever do this. Never. And I've seen this so many times. Never, ever start your presentation asking the audience, do they have any questions? I hate that. I would like, I mean, if you're new to giving presentations, okay, you get a pass. But if you've given one, two, or three, and you're well known for what you're doing, I mean, when we were in our training, which we weren't in together as agents, I can't tell you how many times they brought in an agent. And the first thing, because there, this was a successful agent that we were supposed to be asking questions, and he was going to present something, and then we were going to ask questions. But like, we didn't know this guy from or this woman from anyone other than that they were just very successful. First thing they do, they get introduced, and they go, "Does anybody have any questions?" It's like, I don't know. I don't know who you are. I don't know what you've done. Give me something and then I'll ask you some questions. So you don't want to start that way. It is good to get feedback from an audience, though. You can start to gauge, and nonverbals are very important when you're talking to a live audience. You know, you want to gauge if they're into what you're saying or if they're getting bored or they're picking up their phones or whatever. So it really all applies. The hardest thing, the absolute hardest thing is YouTube, where you don't have a live audience to calibrate, and you just purely have to go off of what you think is going to be interesting to them, what's going to captivate them, what's going to keep them going. And speaking of puzzles, if I didn't change my attitude about YouTube after 7 years and start to think of it as a puzzle and a game, I would have had an aneurysm for sure. And I almost did.
Yeah. You know what strikes me? About what you just said, which is true. And I want to know a little bit how you guess, so to speak, on what's going to resonate, because I'm with you. I would feel lost without the engagement, and whether that's a group engagement or individual engagement, I feel comfortable with that, but no engagement, hoping and guessing. But what strikes me about that is not that concept itself. It's that you are such a pragmatic person. You are such a person that wants things to happen the way they're supposed to happen and logically and in order. And that seems to me like the exact opposite. So are you just nuts? What is it? I mean, is it the challenge of that? Or
I'm a total masochist.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what drives you to do what I agree would be a much harder thing in influencing people that you can't see, touch, interact with and engage. What maddens you to do something like that?
This is not confusing for me at all. I'm a film person. I went to film school. I thought I was going to be a filmmaker, and that's what a filmmaker does. They spend enough time on something, honing it, crafting it, and then they release it out into the world. And ideally, you want to be happy with that, regardless of whether or not other people resonate with it. But you really want to dig deep and find something universal in yourself. And that's why emotions and metaphors are so powerful. Stories are so powerful. But I got to tell you, I think I'm terrible at this. I really do. I am not good at telling stories in my videos. When I was working with YouTube consultants, I would, you know, give the information clear and concise. They were like, okay, this part's great. The moment I tell a story, they're like, you need to cut this part. And I'm like, I thought you just told me I needed to include a story. And they're like, yeah, but this sucks. Like, get rid of it. So I have to go back to that's what I'm trying to do, but that's not what comes out. And that's strange to me too. At the same time, people watch it. And then I go, okay, well, if people are watching it, I'll keep doing it. And so it's very disconnected. I agree with you completely. My personality does not fit this at all. And I remember you telling me, like, you were just like, I didn't see the YouTube thing coming.
And I wasn't trying to be mean. I wasn't just talking to my buddy. I really genuinely, I'm going to be honest, I still don't get it. And when I watch, so I just watched a few minutes of the last podcast you did, and it is still funny to me, not because you're doing anything wrong or funny or bad. It's still just surprising to me. And at the same time, it's resonating. So whatever it is that you're doing, I just don't know how, like I said, you keep going. And you said, well, you almost had an aneurysm. And so you had to change it to a different term. You had to have a puzzle instead of whatever it was. But I admire that. I think I take the easy road in dealing with people directly. I feel like that's
I also
mysterious.
I also like teaching. And this was a weak spot for, like, when I wanted to teach NLP. There was no reason why you would come to me to learn NLP. Why would you just not go to the teachers who taught me, which is what most people were doing? They were already established teachers. What I recognize, and I think for everyone out there, this is another, it's related to influence more than persuasion, maybe. Find what everybody is not doing, and there's your weakness, there's your gap, there's your way in. And so one of the things I noticed, there was maybe two or three pretty good, pretty successful NLP channels on YouTube. And overwhelmingly, I trained with some of the top NLP people in the world, and overwhelmingly, their websites were terrible, and they had no YouTube presence. They had no social media presence. And so I thought, okay, well, here's an opportunity for me to build a following, to find an audience without being drowned out by my own teachers.
Well, what I would say that applies also in other areas, if you find that a market is saturated, well, maybe it's saturated because there's demand. And then what I'm seeing in all of these online courses that suggest that or help you out to start your own business, it's like, just find your own voice. Find what makes you different than the other ones. Because, you know, if you just search on YouTube how to set up a YouTube channel, how to grow a YouTube channel, you can find so many different people teaching you that. And the idea is to just find who you resonate with. So in Damon's case, yes, it was definitely a strength, the fact that the offer was not saturated. They were only the teachers he learned from, and the websites were not up to date. And so he had that extra advantage. But I would say, even if there were already dozens of teachers, you still have your own voice. You have your own style of explaining. And I think that definitely propelled you, because people, or at least lots of people, resonated with your style.
I think that's a really good point. And maybe that's why I do it, because she's absolutely right. Because people will say to me, should I get into YouTube? And these are personal development coaches and teachers. And they think, you know, maybe it's too late. And I was like, you have your own voice. You just don't know what it is yet. And it'll take you about a year to even start to have an idea of what it is. And a year of doing a lot of creation, a lot of consistent content creation. Once you do, there's a following there for you, but it takes a while, and most people aren't patient enough to do it. And the truth is that I'll be honest, I still feel like I haven't found my voice. And I think that maybe that's one of the things that continues to motivate me is like, I feel like there's so much more for me to do, so much more for me to learn, so much more for me to develop. And I want to see where that goes. And I've been doing this for almost 8 years and I feel lost probably 50% of the time.
I have to say, it's not surprising to me that out of this whole conversation, Yulia was the most insightful in bringing in this.
She knows
this,
me a little bit.
This voice. So I just wanted to tap into exactly what you said. In my particular case, in my industry, I'm one of roughly 20 agents in this town that represent the same exact brand and have the same exact product. And yet I outperform all of them. And so what could it be? It can't be what it is that we're selling. It's impossible. It's the same thing. And it is that unique voice. And here's what brings that unique voice, in my opinion. You have to believe it. If you believe the thing that you are demonstrating, saying, selling, whatever it is, if you believe the story you're telling, then that is what brings your authentic voice to it. So you're talking again about the same things. And
that's very persuasive.
And it's very persuasive because that can be felt. It's palpable. If you are ever in the room with somebody who believes every word they're saying, it's hard not to believe. Right? It could be something that you really don't believe. But when that person's passion is oozing out, it's like, wow, there's got to be something to this. Nobody could possibly be that bought into nonsense.
That's an excellent point. You're selling the same product, but you're selling. So I think that's where a lot of people get caught up. They think, well, what I have to offer is either the same or not as good. But that it is about developing that authentic voice. Who's going to listen to you? And what makes you persuasive is that belief in what you're saying. Because, yeah, I'm selling NLP coaching and teaching just like many other people are. So why are people listening to me? The most common compliment that I get is that I'm authentic. People think that I'm authentic and that I can explain things clearly where they feel like other teachers don't. And my response to that is because they don't actually know what they're talking about. Most of them don't. It's true. It's just true. They don't really know what they're talking about.
We'll give you the benefit of the doubt.
Well, they regurgitate what they've learned from their teacher, but they never really explored it. And NLP is experiential. So you have to go and do it. But a lot of people have not done that work. So I think we kind of need to rein this in a little bit, but I want to highlight the three major points. And I think we kind of ended up in a place that I didn't expect, which is wonderful. And this is what part of the magic of when you sit people around a table and you have this conversation, sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. And that's the third lesson, but let's recap the first two. The first one is rapport. You have to know why you're even talking. You even have to know why you're even interacting, right? And the second one is find out what's important to that person. The third one, I think, is when you're going to take that next step to where you're going to align what you want with what they want. And now we're coming to a win-win, which I thought this was going to be the third lesson is like, how do you have a win-win out of this? I think it's more about really finding your unique voice where you're delivering that message that yes, thousands, if not millions of people are delivering as well and competing for that person's attention. But you have a voice that has something in it that takes cultivation, that takes practice, that takes being vulnerable and really willing to put your heart and your true feelings out there. I really do. I think you have to go at this 100%. When Bruce Lee was asked, why does he yell and scream whenever he's hitting and striking? And he's like, because I give 100% of everything. And so I'm giving my spirit, I'm giving my voice, I'm giving my breath, like he's doing everything. And I think if you're really going to create that unique voice, that's going to cultivate followers, that's going to create influence for you, that's going to make you persuasive. That's what you need to do. You need to really put it all out there on the line. I think that makes a huge difference. Anybody disagree with that?
Nope. I'm just surprised every time at how much I enjoy talking to you.
I'm just a great talker.
Wonderful conversationalist. I don't know what to say.
Well, that's what was happening. We were having these conversations at lunch and that's what we talked about doing a podcast for years. And then she was, she came with us. She usually comes with us and we were having this conversation. And then after we come out and she's like, wow, that was a really good conversation. I was like, yeah, we need to get this in front of a camera. We need to make this happen. And Nate and I have wonderful conversations too. The only problem is we don't see enough of each other in person. But there, that makes a difference. It really does make a difference to have people in person. Now, I asked both of you to just come up with three bullet points of, it could be basically maybe what we already talked about, or it could be more about like, what is the next step? You know, you heard these learnings, these lessons, these truths about what it takes to influence and persuade people. What are some next steps for people out there who are listening? What would you recommend that they do?
Practice. It is easy to learn these things. Most people are intelligent enough to read this, and it makes 100% sense. It's contextually relevant. They get it, but they don't actually implement it. So practice, 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 practice. So no matter what you do to be good at something, you have to practice it. Why children become good at things is because they're unafraid to continue to practice when they fail. And as adults, we view it as a failure. And so we are less and less willing to practice. So be brave enough to practice. You are going to fall flat on your face 1,000 times. You got to practice it 2,000 times. So practice. That's what I think.
Right. That's it. You don't have two more things.
Oh, I just thought you said the next step. I could give you the bullet points.
Let's give it two more things. So practice.
Well, I think you have to elicit emotion. And in order to do that, you need to understand what people are after. So you need to, again, practice active listening and try to implement what you do in that practice. And then, you know, there's a call to action. There must be an intent. So you lead with this. You lead with intent. Maybe mine comes towards the end, but there must be an intention to these things. So there needs to be a clear intention.
We never know what Nates are because he's so subtle. Just like
I still don't know what Nates are.
You find yourself doing this and you're like, how did I end up doing this? I don't remember agreeing to this. I don't remember Nate saying anything about this, but yet I'm doing exactly, I'm like, you know, helping him with his taxes. And yeah. anything else that you want to add?
No, I'm just going back to the active listening. I think that's the most important thing.
Okay. Nate, what's three things? Bullet pointed, you know, really concise. They could be rehashing what we've already talked about or next steps for anyone listening. You know, they absorbed what we talked about, absorbed those lessons, and then they're saying, but what do I do now?
Sure. So since you're practicing, there's a few things to practice is look for the way that you can help when you're interacting with people. Be really interested in how that's possible. Look for the puzzles and see if just out of practice, see if you can become the kind of person that they would want by their side because you're able to help them solve that puzzle. If you're practicing doing that, a lot of the rest of the skill sets will start to fall in line. And if you're doing that from an authentic place, then you're going to unconsciously establish a level of leadership that is that a lot of people try to do and they really struggle with. So I think that's it.
How do you eat an elephant?
One piece at a time.
Exactly. And so that's the next step I would recommend. Choose an area that you want to, where you want to become really good at influencing and persuading. My first mistake was to try to just go out into the world and be more persuasive and more influential. And I just fell flat on my face. I'm what I would call a medium chunk person. I would call Nate a big chunk person. I would just call you a chunk.
That was just the easy way out right there. You get some better content in these things, man.
Actually, I think
cheap shots.
I think you're very flexible, so it's hard to say what chunk you are. Some people need things in very small bites. Some people are big dreamers. Nate's a big dreamer. You're a visionary, kind of like you want to consume the whole thing all at once. And I need medium chunks. And so I divide up my life. I do this all the time into like 3 to 5 major life contexts, and then I look at them and I say, okay, what do I want in each one of them? So I would do the same for persuading and influencing. Focus on an area. Now, when I got divorced, my main focus, well, when I first had a business, I'd never done sales before. So the focus was learn how to do sales. When I got divorced, my focus became, okay, how to getting, I'll just be honest, getting into seduction. But I did want a life partner. It wasn't just about, you know, having these crazy adventures. So I focused my attention there. And so
if there is a crazy adventure podcast though, right?
Well, we can talk about that after. So what I have found is that anytime I carve out an area of life and I focus on what it is either that I want or I want to become better at, it works. But it's, you have to narrow it down enough to make it a chunk size that you can consume, that you can bite off of and actually focus on and work. So I think that's really important. I think it's also very important. I do this a lot, probably to a fault, and you get on my case about this. Find somebody who's doing what you're doing that you want to do very well and learn from that person.
And just don't idolize that person.
I have a tendency to have bromances and get into a little bit of too much admiring. And then also, it's not just that. I think it's always thinking that someone else has the answers and that you don't. And mm-hmm. you're really good to get feedback on, because you'll put that right in front of my face and say, okay, Damon, what makes you think you don't have this figured out? Or what makes you think you can't figure this out? And I needed to hear that so many times. So thank you. It helps to put yourself around people who will tell you the truth. It's not the ultimate truth, but you're telling me what you see, and you're not inserting your own self-interest.
It's the honest. There is no truth. It's the honest,
right?
The way I see it.
Right. And then third, I agree with what everyone else here has said. You have to practice. Don't think that you're just going to read a book or learn a language pattern and then you're going to go out there and be able to persuade and influence. It does not work that way. You really do have to practice this. And I think that's the main thing. When I said, you know, there's a lot of NLP teachers who don't really know what they're talking about. When they're asked a question, they're like a deer in the headlights because they have a script, and that script is, I don't mean like they've memorized a script ahead of time, but they're just using the script that they borrowed from their teacher, and they're just basically saying the same words, but they don't really understand what they mean. Whereas when I was learning this, I think the good thing that I had was I didn't really want to be a teacher. I didn't really want to be a coach. I wanted to save my marriage and my insurance business. And so that's what I was focused on. I knew that it took practice to get good at it. And then as a result of that, people were like, you know, you're pretty good at this. Maybe you should try teaching it, or maybe you should try coaching. So that's how I got good at it. And you cannot get around practice. And yes, practice is uncomfortable, because anytime you put yourself in a situation where you aren't certain about everything, where you don't know how to do things, and which requires you to learn, and you have to practice it, you're putting yourself in discomfort. And that's why people avoid it so much. How you get that edge is by being the person who will do things that other people won't do.
Amen.
All right, before we wrap this up, anybody else have any other words, anything you want to add?
I think this covers a lot.
I think we like did cover a lot, yeah.
Yeah, we covered plenty of strategies and approaches.
Which is good, because we're never going to have Chris back on ever again. So
they don't pay enough, folks.
We really didn't. We were cheap. All right. So persuasion and influence is one of the greatest skills that you can cultivate and learn in order to get what you want. Your ability to communicate is the single most important factor that will determine how successful you become in any way that you define success. Learning to communicate your ideas clearly and concisely is extremely important. But if you neglect learning how to get people to do what you want, you will not become the success that you could be. Everyone agree with that?
Yes.
All right.
All right. I'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.